Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, along with K2 KEUM Mel. We run this thing called the TechNet on Sunday night, starting at 8 o'clock. And the main purpose of that TechNet, as you heard 1,198 times before, is to transfer information to each other. We amateurs are very good communicators, it says here, and we help each other understand how to get the best performance out of our equipment, best transmitters and receivers and antennas and feed lines and propagation and so on. We also accept questions on subjects of interest to ham radio operators, so it includes quite a few of the other kinds of electronics in the house, usually wireless, but not always. Occasionally we get into computers and high-definition television and things like this. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So, do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name, and that's yes at this time, K2RIW.
K2T6, no. H-O-I-Y, Joe, yes.
Okay, so far we've got Joe for sure, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. There was a KC-2 and also a TP-something. Both of those guys were dropping out. The machine may be getting some extra noise tonight. So we've only got one check-in so far. Anyone else want to check in?
Okay. This is Chris.
You might want to remind some of these people that this repeater link is in Selden. In case they're out that way, they might make it better in Selden than into Glen Oaks.
Yeah, good suggestion that Joe's making. The normal repeater is on 2585, but there is a directly linked repeater called the 147375 with 600 KCF, 375, 875, I think it is. 975. So a person who's out of range out east on Long Island might check into the 147375. Same PL, 146.5. So far we got one check-in. We heard a KC2, then we heard a Chris, and we heard a TP. I don't know if it's the same person. Give me a call letters if you want to check in. K2RIW.
Yeah, call this. I'm on the Bell Parkway there. Guess my signal there kind of got a little lost. It's Chris here from Canarsie area, Brooklyn.
Okay, now we know it's Chris, Canarsie area, Brooklyn, Bell Parkway. But you spoke so loud, you jumped out of the machine when you gave us your call letters. Try again, Chris.
Okay, KC2. Oh, CF. Got the next KC2. Talk to you, Mike.
WA2CDL for K2RIW.
WA2CDL. Go right ahead, Andy.
Okay, just to inform you, Dick, there was a problem this week with the computer at the Selden site. There is no link at this time. Just brought the repeater up. Repeater does key, but it's not linked together. Apparently the hard drive developed a problem, and the computer is not working right now. So just to let you know.
Thank you, Andy. Good information. We had some wicked lightning in my neighborhood. I heard reports of hail. There was a lightning strike that took place in a park in Hicksville, and 5 human beings were struck. Don't know the status of this human being. So those are some of the reports, and various places were getting hail. So after everyone signs in, we'll ask various people what they experienced during this so-called violent storm. All right, right now we've got Chris from Bell Parkway, KC2, I think it's OCF, and Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Will you be HWW with info, Dick, please.
Okay, HWW, Howie, we got with info. Anyone else?
This is Echo Whiskey Kilo, W2, EWK, Eugene,
Edward, I'm clearly.
I just need 1 minute, please.
OCM, OCM.
My goodness, Nancy 2 Fox, Lima to Fox. Mark, and no.
Hello, Andy. WDTXW, back to you, Dick.
KF2TP, Rick, no.
Good evening, K2KEY.
And WS2N, I'll give you a small space report. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, in reverse order, we've got Paul with the yes with the space report, no, checking in. Oscar Charlie Mike, we finally got Chris's call letters, probably right. MLF, Mark, I think it is, with a no. FTP, Rich, I think, with a no. Eugene with a yes. Howie with a yes. Anyone else?
Call sign correct. See ya.
Very good, Chris. Okay, Howie, I think you said you've got some information you should give us real fast. Go right ahead with it. Okay, maybe Howie's not available right now. Rich, there we go. Joe, W-E-2-R-Y-Y. Go right ahead, Joe.
Let me turn that way on the radio here. Yes, I have two questions for you. The first question is, I sent you two emails this past week. You only answered one of them. Was there a reason why you only answered one?
I gave you a great big long answer to the first one. I didn't get a second one. I'll have to check in my so-called junk list. I used to get, because of my website, 300 or so spams per day, and my son established for me a very robust firewall system, and occasionally a false alarm. So maybe your email got to the wrong list, Rich. Okay, here we go, Joe, and I'll check on that. Why don't you tell me now what it was, and maybe we'll discuss it. You got it, Joe.
Oh, I'll just resend it again to you. But they were all sent to the same address. Okay, the second question is the subject that I was talking about last week, which was microwave ovens and how to measure their efficiency. And I did do some experimentation, as you suggested.
Yeah, what you're really doing is a calorimetry experiment. One of the most famous ways of building a calorimeter, and what a calorimeter is something that measures calories. That's a fancy way of saying, if you have a kind of a reaction that's taking place, and you want to know how much energy is being dissipated in the reaction, you put the energy-producing process, like, say, for instance, burning a piece of wood, you put that inside of a small chamber that's inside of a body of water. And so, in theory, all of the heat of the reaction goes into the water. Water is an extremely linear process as far as how much energy you put into the water and how much the temperature changes. So by you putting a known amount of water, which is a beautiful absorber of microwaves, into your microwave oven, and then measuring the temperature before and after you run the microwave oven for a known length of time, you'll know exactly how many joules of energy was coupled into that water. And knowing the length of time that it took to do that, you can calculate that into watts, and therefore you'll eventually know exactly how many watts your oven is distributing to its food. Another thing you want to know about is the conversion factors, and there's a couple of very good books on that subject. There's a lot of good websites that'll tell you how to convert calories into watts, into joules, into British thermal units, all of these things. Now, calorimetry is not quite as bad as magnetics. Be happy about the fact you're not delving into magnetics. My goodness, they've got 8 different terms to describe magnetic fields, and rather poor definitions. You go to any of the websites on that and look for definitions, and it gets very confusing. But calorimetry in a lot better shape. So how many grams of water, how many ounces of water, what length of time, and how many degrees of Fahrenheit or centigrade change did you see?
Mm-hmm.
And when you did that calculation, what did you come up with, Joe? The B-U-R-Y-1.
Okay, very good. Well, I tried to do a little on the scientific side of it, keeping the starting point the same, and it was a little difficult, and it took quite a while to get it to do that. I used, the first experiment, I used 2 16-ounce glasses, well, actually cups of water, older coffee cups, all right? And I measured those fairly precisely, so it was 2 16-ounce cups of coffee, cups with water in them, I should just, all right? And my starting temperature on all these tests was 40 degrees. If I had the chiller water, it went below 40, I would let it warm up to 40. I measured it with a glass thermometer in the water itself, made sure there's no ice, because heating up ice would foul up the experiment. You know that, and I know that. Okay. The first test, with two glasses of 16-ounce containers, 1 minute, I started at 40 degrees, and I ended up with a temperature of 60 degrees. I did the same experiment again by chilling the water down with two cups, and I went from 40 degrees to 77 degrees in 2 minutes' time. So those are your first figures. The second test I did with a single cup, 16-ounce water, 1 minute, 40 degrees start, 77 degrees stop at 1 minute. Second test, 2 minutes, 40 degrees start, 94 degrees stop.
Okay, I wasn't sure. Did you turn them back to me, Joe?
Yeah, I did. I think I did. I let the button go, but maybe I should have shifted over.
Yeah, it turns out we were getting some static in the background. That was a little bit confusing. I'm a little worried about something. You said you started off with a 16-ounce coffee cup. By my standards, that's a very large coffee cup, a very large chunk of porcelain. Did you weigh the amount of porcelain that was there and take into account the what's called specific heat of porcelain? For this to be done ideally, you would have a very thin, light plastic cup, a foam cup that has no mass to it, or one of these very thin, clear plastic cups. But when it comes to the very large coffee cup, you're now heating up also a great big chunk of porcelain, is what I think, with the handle on the coffee cup and so on. I wonder if you're worried about that a little bit, Joe. Go ahead.
No, I'm not worried about it at all, because I never mentioned porcelain coffee cup. You jumped the gun on that one. The coffee cup, actually, I said, was an old coffee cup, and it was made of paper, like the kind you get out of 7-Eleven.
Fantastic. Okay, you did it right. You did it right. So, those kind of paper coffee cups, a low-mass cup with nothing in it but water. And what's your guess as to why the temperatures seem to be a little bit different? In other words, you would expect twice the number of degrees of centigrade change, or Fahrenheit change, when you did it for 2 minutes versus 1 minute, or when you did it half or twice the amount of water. You got a good relationship, but not quite linear. That's my first question. And second of all, when you calculated those delta temperatures of water back into calories, BTUs, watts, joules, whatever, what did you eventually come up with for watts that appears to be coming out of your microwave oven? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Well, you see, I don't know how to calculate that, and that's the purpose of asking this question. The purpose of the question was to try to determine how much energy the microwave unit is producing. And I know how much amperage it draws off 120 volt wall socket. I did measure the amperage, and I can subtract the tenth of an amp for the light bulb inside and the tenth of an amp that runs the electronics. So the microwave draws 10 amps on high, and it's actually 9.8 amps if you might subtract the electronics and subtract the small, must be about like a 12 watt light or 12 or 15 watt light, but they each were a tenth of an amp measurement. So that's what I'm trying to find out, how much energy is producing, to know what the approximate efficiency is of the unit itself. I thought you would know more about the calculating this thing into a mass of water and so many watts would heat it up for so many minutes, it would equal so many watts to do that. You're right, my temperature readings were not quite linear. Like I said, the first one heating up with two cups side by side Actually, it's funny. That's an average temperature because one on one side of the oven gave me a rise of 59 degrees, and the other one on the right side gave me a rise of to 61 degrees, both starting at 40. When I heat up for 2 minutes, my average was 77 degrees. One measured like 75, the other was like 79. So it's interesting. But that's what I was trying to basically determine. Is, you know, how much energy is, you know, produced. I don't know all these formulas. That's why I'm asking the question over here. If I should seek this on the internet, I'll do so.
Yeah, don't worry. You're going to get an answer. Just the process. I think I vaguely promised you last week that I would look up those conversion factors. I didn't do that. I've got a calculator in front of me with all of those conversion factors built into it. And as soon as we get a period of time, like when Paul is doing his speech on what's going on in space, or when Mel is telling us what his mailbag told him, when I get a little bit of delay in time and those guys are taking over, I'll do the conversion for you. Let's make sure I got the raw data right. The very first experiment, 32 ounces of water total, a pair of glasses, two 16-ounce glasses, 40 degrees Fahrenheit start, 1 minute, 60 degrees Fahrenheit average end. When you did the exact same experiment for 2 minutes, 40 degrees start became 77. Let's see, 40 to 60 is 20 degrees change. 40 to 80 would have been enough. 40 degrees change. It went to 77. You're 3 degrees shy on the 2 minute one. Also, when you did the 16 ounce cup, 40 degrees start, 77. And I see a trend here for 1 minute. And then 2 minutes, 90. I'm wondering, there's a slim possibility you're thermometer has a little bit of non-linearity to it, but we won't worry about that. You've got some very good averages here. They're close enough. I see a 5% delta or something like that. It's not a showstopper. In other words, if we calculate that your oven is producing 700 watts and it's really producing 685, I don't think you'd really care. It's close enough. That's what we want to know. So, we'll get to that as soon as I get a little bit of free time. Back to you, Joe, to make sure I've got all the raw data right. And the very last experiment was 2 minutes, 16 ounces, 40 degrees start, 94 degrees end. W2RYY for any corrections. K2RYW on the TechNet.
Nope, you have all the data correct as I read it and I tried to calculate it. Well, it's a regular household thermometer, the kind you hang on the wall, it just tells you temperature. Glass thermometer. Red type, which I think is alcohol-based, so I believe they're not quite as accurate as possibly a mercury thermometer. But I didn't want to use that. I have one of those, but I want to use it because I want to over-temperature the thing and have the thing go out of range and explode the thermometer, so I used a red one. But if the thermometer is not completely linear, well, I think for this experiment, it doesn't really totally matter. Like you said, if the oven is producing 750 watts or 800 or 725 or 775, it's not going to really matter too terribly much.
You got it, Joe. Good experiment. Okay, the very next person who signed in, I think was Howie, W2HWW, with some info. Go right ahead, Howie. Okay, maybe Howie got called away. Eugene, W2EWK. What's going on in your neighborhood, Eugene? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, W2EWK. I just bought a 2000 Mustang.
I have an
Icon 7000 in the trunk. It's 100 watts even on HF. On 2 meters and 440, I'll take my guess, it's about 50, 60 watts.
Yeah, that sounds very safe. If you're putting a kilowatt into it, and if it was on the forward, the engine compartment of the car, and you're looking right through the windshield at the kilowatt, and it's pushing your luck a little bit, depending on how long you do the key down. With some fairly simple calculations, you'll find out an awful lot of the things that amateurs do, as far as radio frequency biohazard are concerned, are rather safe. You'd have to be located 1 or 2 feet away from the antenna, with a whole lot of power, quite a few hundred watts going into the antenna, and stay there for 6 solid minutes in order to exceed the minimum or maximum permitted exposure for radio frequency biohazard. I don't think you're going to have a problem. One other thing you've got to worry about a little bit is how well bypassed the 12-volt lead is. You'll find out that most rigs, the 12-volt lead is on the rig itself, very well bypassed. It's only on these brick amplifiers. In the case of a brick amplifier, quite often the 12-volt lead is very poorly bypassed, and a hell of a lot of RF energy comes out of the 12-volt lead. But in the case of a total rig, like your IC7000, that should work like a charm. I don't even think you're going to run into any problem with the instrument panel going crazy. Now, the only other thing you've got to worry, about a little bit is that the 12-volt wiring that goes all the way to the trunk from the battery, which is probably up forward, should be some awfully heavy gauge to make sure you're not getting a great big voltage drop. And there should be a fuse on at least the plus 12-volt lead right at the battery. Something like a 20-ampere fuse, I think, would do it in your case. But just in case that wiring that you're going to run all the way to the trunk, that heavy gauge wiring should ever short to the chassis by mistake. You probably already installed that fuse, haven't you, Eugene? W2EWK, K2IYW on the TechNet.
Yes, there, Dick. I'm going to take it to a stereo store, and I'll go let him, deal with it, because I'm looking forward to the cosmetic work, and I'm going to hook the wiring only. And I was thinking in the future, I was thinking of... I'm kidding you about that part, but it's going to be all stock only. So, the thickness of the wire is the same thickness of the wire that comes with the radio. QSL there, Dick, W2EWK.
Yeah, you might want to go up a gauge. The wiring that's on the radio is probably only a lead that's 3 feet or 4 feet long. To go all the way to the trunk, you're going to run something like 15 feet of wire. My recommendation is 8-gauge stranded wire or thicker to make sure you don't get a great big voltage drop. I also recommend that you run the wiring to the trunk on both the plus twisted together, running from the battery to the trunk to the rig. That way you're not depending on the frame of the car to conduct all of the current, because that can give you some grief. So by running a twisted pair out there, of at least 8-gauge, and I've done installations like that, I think you're going to run into no trouble. Back to you, Eugene.
Okay, so I want a little bit better than 8-gauge. Okay, shall do then, Dick. I'll let you know how I make out. Tomorrow the car is going to the shop to have some odds and ends fixed on it, to the body shop, the scratches and that stuff, take it out of the car. But other than that, then... as soon as I get the car back, I'll be taking it to the stereo store and going for the heavy-duty gauge wire, which they do have, a little bit more bigger than 8-gauge. Okay there, Dick, and I'll keep away from the IC-CW1. I want to use that wing amplifier, just keep in the house. W2EWK clear.
Sounds good, Eugene. I said 1-gauge heavier than the wire that comes out of the radio. I didn't say 1-gauge heavier than 8. It is my guess that 8-gauge is probably enough. But maybe we've got somebody on frequency that's got different opinions. If so, they'll express it. I think 8-gauge will do it, though. But the wiring that's on the rig is a much shorter lead, and therefore it can be a lower gauge. As you make the wire longer and longer, you get more and more voltage drop, and therefore you have to go to a heavier gauge to make sure you don't get a great big voltage drop. Many rigs... when the car is running and the generator is generating and you're putting 13.8 volts into the battery, and if you drop that voltage down to 12.8, so to speak, through the wiring, that's pretty good. But there are certain rigs, like my Kenwood 751, is it? Anyhow, my Kenwood rig, the 2-meter all mode, and I'll find the model number in a second. Stand by.
Central charger that has a lower voltage than the regular net acid. Just charge your arm with a higher voltage and blows them up. He's blown up a couple. I want to give him a couple. He's got some good technical information on it. But I know you put him up in the plate, over.
I can tell somebody's trying to give us information. We're only getting 20% copy, and you keep dropping out. So wherever you're located, you're in a bad spot, or not running enough power, or whatever. I know you're giving us information, but we essentially didn't get it. Sorry to say. So what I was about to say, though, is my Kenwood 751A, 2-meter oil mode, I noticed that if I go below approximately 12.1 volts going to that rig in the sideband mode, the phase lock loop drops out and starts putting out some pretty ugly sounds. So there are certain rigs like that where the internal regulator drops out at around 12. I wish that rig would go down to about 11.5, because when the generator of the car is not running and the battery is only putting out, we'll say, 12.4 volts, and with an ordinary wiring drop, the rig is getting something like 11.9, and the rig becomes very unhappy. So that particular rig, I can only run it when the car is running. And the car can't be idling. The car's got to be running at full speed for enough voltage to be generated to keep that particular transmitter happy. That's a funny quirk. And so you got to worry about that with some of these rigs. And if you have any further comments, give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Go ahead, Mel.
Now, Roger, that radio, the 7000, I've used it. A friend of mine had one. And I've used it in the mobile with the engine off on my auxiliary battery. And the radio still worked perfect at 10.75 volts. In fact, a number of them will work down to that. I was sitting in a mobile today because of the lightning situation, and where he tried to conduct a 10-meter net to some extent. So I did it from my mobile in my driveway. And I sat for about 4 hours until my radio started give me a little problem. I have an ICOM IC718, and the battery voltage was reading out at about 10.6 when it started to act a little strange. Over.
Very fine, Mel. Done. Down to 10.75. Oh, amazing. And as I said, my Kenwood 751A, wow, is it sensitive on voltage. Now, I had a lightning strike that happened very close to my house. I heard a report that the Dixville Fire Department had some grief with their main control panel at their fire department headquarters. There was a fire in a house that was only a few blocks away from mine. So I know that lightning struck very, very close. I heard reports of hail in various towns, and a lightning strike did take place in Hicksville, as I mentioned earlier. And 5 people were struck with that lightning when they were in a park in Hicksville. As far as the guys are within the sound of my voice, if you saw some interesting weather today, like a tremendous amount of rain, hail, lightning, whatever, or channels, if you were watching any of the websites that will show you radar pictures of where the rain is happening, there was a whole lot of rain cells starting off in roughly eastern Pennsylvania, going through New Jersey and wiping their way across Long Island. And quite a few of them were west of where I live, and a few of them were east of me. And some of them were pretty violent. So if you guys have got a story, give us your call. That is right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Man,
that's...
How you doing, Dick? Frank here in Bohemia.
WW2WW. NY3H. Okay, we got NY3H, we got Frank, and the quadruple W. Frank, what was your call letters?
WN2VUU, Whiskey November 2, Victor United, United. Over here in Bohemia.
Okay, NY3 Hotel was the first one to sign it. Start up with your name, and what did you see, sir?
My name is Harris. I am a Limark member, and I'm also the Nassau County Sky One coordinator. Any stations wishing to check in when we do have a severe weather warning, we encourage those who have been trained or have not been trained Sky One to check into the Sky One net on 146805. Roger.
Okay, so I think you're saying Scott the mark list right now. Be right back. Okay. Harris, you live in Bethpage, and I think Bethpage had some pretty wicked weather this morning. Is that true, Harris?
We had about just short of 2 inches of rain at my location. but the call in tonight is to encourage anyone who would like to participate in the Sky One program when we go from a weather watch to a weather warning. When I'm here local, we'll be conducting, convening a net on 146.805 for Sky One, and any major anomalies or information that needs to be passed on to the National Weather Service, we do. We did have quarter-sized hail up in one section of the county, which is sort of an anomaly that was south of Manhattan. But we do have open communication with the National Weather Service, and we do encourage you all to join our nets.
Wow, quarter-size hail in South Manhasset, and 146.805. Okay, I got that wrong the first time. Roughly from what hour to what hour was that Sky One net in operation today, Harris? Go ahead.
We actually were activated twice. One about 10:15, which was over around 11 o'clock, and the other one was about 11:15, and that went on to, I would say, about 12:30. That was the majority of our activity, so I monitored through the day any conditions that the stations didn't report. Again, I only activate the net when the National Weather Service takes us from a watch to a warning. So we go along with the, if you look at radar, anyone looks at radar, when we're in a yellow box or a red box, we'll be activated. This is November Yankee 3 Hotel.
Very fine, Harrison. Thank you for all the information. So 10:15 to 11, and 11:15 to 12:30 roughly. Sky One, because watch went to warning, and you guys are on 146.85. And so other people who are wishing to participate to that program, now you know where to go and when. 146.805, probably 4ZPL. Out of curiosity, Harris, that located, I should know, but I don't. The 805 repeater is located in what town as far as its input is concerned? That'll help people know, will they have any trouble getting to it. You got it, Harris.
I believe that's in Plainview, but I may be mistaken.
Plainview is correct.
The repeater is located, but it does have very good coverage throughout the county. So there's a very good chance that you'll be able to make the repeater. I also run APRS, and I run Winlink, so if people want to contact me with reports, they can do it through my call, NY3H, at winlink.org. I have that up and running, or on the 144-390, the APRS frequency, if they're running APRS. Roger.
Okay, somebody did sign in and say that Plainview is correct. Winlink.org is another way to get a hold of you. Good information. Thank you, Harris. Frank, what did you see over there in Bohemia? WN2, I think it's VUU, I think it is. K2RW in the tech net.
Hey, Dick, this is Lou, Frank's neighbor, W2NVUU. Yeah, we had a pretty much of an experience over here. I was on the other side, you know, from his house. And I was able to witness a lightning bolt strike within about, well, I'd say about 10 feet from Frank's house. And not to mention, we had pea-sized hail coming down over here with torrents of rain that we have at least about 2.5 feet of, 2.5 inches of rain. And then some parts of the road were severely flooded over here. Not to mention that we had a lot of, it's like a tornadic activity in a sense, because you would see the trees swinging one direction, next minute later to the other direction, and then you look at another area and the trees were just sitting there not doing anything.
Sorry, I was looking something up. Sounds like Bohemia had a real good smashing there, Lou, with pea-sized hail, all that rain, all that wind, you can get some pretty violent squalls at times. I could tell by the weather map I was looking at times the portions of the map were turning red, which shows pretty severe activity, and then occasionally even turning purple, which is the next step up in activity. So I knew things were getting pretty pretty violent. Tim, what did you see over there in, I think you live in Keensburg, New Jersey, if I understand correctly, Tim. What did you see over there?
Good evening. Yeah, we're now shacking up closer to Sandy Hook. We're over in the Highlands, and we have some bad reports to give tonight about the weather. One quick comment about the radios and eDrop. I run the 857D out of my car, and I also work that down close to 10 volts without any kind of backtalk from that radio. So it seems like a lot of the new radios nowadays are becoming more versatile to variable voltage, which is a good thing. You can shut off the car a little bit. Second, bringing in about the lightning. Today on Sandy Hook, we have a fatality to report. The lightning struck three people, one fatality, two in critical condition in Jersey Shore. Happened around 2 o'clock this afternoon. We had a tremendous amount of lightning today from 6 o'clock this morning on through most of the day. It just seemed like we were in the pattern of the train, and every time the train came through, it blew its horn real hard. And there was lightning today that had more purpose than I've ever seen before in lightning strikes. It just was absolute cloud to ground vertical. You could have almost drawn a line with some of these strikes. You know, living near the ground constant of the water, being right in that Sandy Hook region right there, you're kind of in the heat of it. But boy, I'll tell you, it was absolutely some of the most intense lightning I've seen in a 12-hour period in my 40-some-odd years being here by the Jersey Shore. One other note, let me recycle. It brings up a question. The question that I have, I see lots of people diving from their radios when lightning comes. My thought is, I don't have a thought, I actually have a question, and it brings up a big question in my head, is does the energy that's emitted from your antenna in a transmission, does it enhance attractual properties of electrical strikes of lightning? Or is it just getting off the radio for the sake of being safe? Emittance of your properties, of the electrical properties of your antenna during emittance of transmission, does that actually enhance attraction, or is it still just more or less a strike, kind of like standing in the middle of anywhere, getting it anywhere? That would interest me if you could comment on that. WW2WW, back to that.
Very fine, Tim. I'm going to answer your question on my second transmission. On this particular transmission, though, can you tell me, in the case of the three people who were struck and one of them is a fatality, do you happen to know what they were doing at the time? And second of all, when you said it's the most intense lightning you've ever seen, are you talking about the intensity of each individual lightning bolt, how loud and how intense it was, or are you talking about the frequency of lightning bolts? Are you seeing a lightning bolt every 5 seconds? But so were the lightning bolts intense individually, or was it just because there were so many of them at once? And what were those people doing who were struck? I think you said three were struck and one was a fatality. Back to you, Tim.
Okay, in answer to your answer, I'd say I'd have to say both. It was not only the intensity of each strike, but the frequency of strikes as well. And it's amazing. And what I've noticed is listening to the radio while it strikes, it's almost like it gives a signal onto the radio and then dissipates. It's so strange. But anyway, the three people were actually leaving the beach. They were walking off together. From what I heard, they were not holding hands, but the person that took the strike on, it seemed like the person on one side took the strike and it ran across all three of them in the same bolt. That person, his whole neck got blown out. I don't know if anyone has ever seen anyone that's been electrocuted, but I've been a medic for years. When someone is electrocuted, it seems like the soft pockets, like under the arms and in the groin and in the neck area where there's a lot of liquid and heat and moisture from the body, it seems to explode when electricity goes through the body, if enough current actually goes through the body. And this person actually had experienced that in his neck. He had explosions, implosions, whatever you want to call them, on his neck from the actual current going through the body. So they were all together and they were walking off the beach and it was a single strike. Over.
Wow. Okay, now, there are normal and abnormal lightning bolts. The so-called normal ones are where the bottom layer of the cloud initiates the lightning and is negatively charged. Those are the lightning bolts that are in the vicinity of 11,000 amperes for something like 20 microseconds. And what you think is one lightning bolt, if you had a high-speed photography, you'd find out it's about 2, 3, 4, or 5 individual strikes in very rapid succession. So, negative bottom of the cloud, because electrons emit much more easily, the lightning bolt, you could say, happens before the voltage builds up as high. Occasionally, you get one of two things happening. Either a lightning bolt in some strange region comes from the top of the cloud, which is normally positively charged, or the cloud itself builds itself up upside down. But when you get positive polarity lightning, in other words, the upper end of the path being positive as opposed to being negative, those lightning bolts are approximately 10 times more severe. Instead of 11,000 amperes, they're closer to 75 or 100,000 amperes, each individual lightning bolt. You can tell the difference because the sound is tremendously louder. You'll recognize that difference immediately, and the flash itself looks much more intense. So for reasons that are not well understood, occasionally Mother Nature makes positive lightning bolts instead of negative ones. When she makes the positive ones, look out. Those are really wicked. Now, let me drop and I'll answer your original question. I've been doing a fair amount of experimenting with high voltage over the last 2 years. I had a particular consulting client that needed a product developed that needed high voltage and understanding of high voltage. So I've acquired some of these machines like a Van de Graaff generator. I don't have a Tesla coil. I'm looking for DC, not AC. I got a Van de Graaff generator and a couple of Wimsers machines. So I have seen what 200,000 or 300,000 volts will do when it arcs through air and arcs through a distance of about 3.5 inches. And I've looked at it in the dark. I've looked at it with high current, low current, high voltage, low voltage, sharp points, round points, whatever, light up fluorescent tubes and so on. The conclusion I've come to, and this is a bunch of opinions, not exactly traceable to the Bureau, but I'll give you a few more hints about what I think is happening and what other questions to ask when you go to your Wikipedia or whatever. As I see it, a lightning bolt and an arcing in air both require free electrons. Those free electrons must be moving fast enough in order to ionize the air. In other words, the voltage has to be high enough that when the electron gets moving, it gets a chance to build up enough velocity that when he hits the very next air molecule, that free electron, he hits it with enough force that he dislodges two more electrons, or at least one more electron. So you get an avalanche effect. So it takes high enough voltage, enough air density, to get enough velocity of the electron to start the avalanche approach, avalanche process, and that's what the lightning bolt really is. Let me drop. So, one very good piece of news is that, with rare exceptions, our antennas, our ham radio antennas, do not issue free electrons. We, by way of the transmitter, by way of the transmission line, and the input terminals to the antenna, we are pumping electrons into the right-hand side of the dipole and taking them out of the left-hand side of the dipole on the first half of the cycle. And the other half cycle, you're reversing it. We are pumping electrons back and forth into the dipole. That, in turn, creates a hard current. The current creates a magnetic field. You could say, simplistically, the magnetic field is the beginning of the process itself, with rare exceptions, does not emit free electrons. Now, there's a couple of exceptions to that. There are guys who have operated a 160-meter monopole antenna on an automobile with a great big loading coil and a sharp point at the top, and as they speak into the microphone of a 150-watt or 200-watt sideband rig, you will see some corona arcing, purple flash in the dark, coming off the tip of that antenna. Yes, you could design an antenna that's going to give you some arcing at the tip, but that's an unusual situation. A very low frequency, a very small antenna, very high in Q, a lot of voltage buildup, loading coils, lots of power going into it, and now you can listen to the sparking and arcing coming off the end of the antenna, and it has a characteristic that follows your voice when you speak into that single sideband transmitter. There's a YouTube movie you can go to that shows you that effect, but that's rare. For the most part, our antennas do not emit electrons. Therefore, to my knowledge, they do not enhance the lightning phenomenon. Now, to walk away from the rig because it's connected with the transmission line up to an antenna that's high in the air, and the antenna high in the air has a higher probability of being struck than, let's say, the house. And therefore, to disconnect that cable, to walk away from the rig, that is showing good prudence and erring on the side of conservativeness and being on the safe side. I can understand that. But whether or not the transmitter is transmitting or not transmitting, it is my belief there is no difference. Now, maybe the people on frequency have got an altering opinion. If so, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
WH4YY, I have a question on what you've been saying about the amperage of these strikes. How has this been determined by instrumentation? Because that's got to be an interesting answer with the high enough potential of each particular strike with reference to the, you know, from point to point. Aren't you talking about several hundred million volts of the potential?
Without a doubt, Joe. The actual voltage on the cloud is some number of megavolts. But one of the big mysteries for a long time is you measure the megavolts that's in the cloud, and there's various ways you can do that. It's an estimating process in some cases, but you definitely can tell the difference between 2 megavolts and 200 megavolts. So within at least an order of magnitude, if not a hell of a lot closer, and you can also fly a radio control model airplane in there and make measurements and so on. There's various ways you can find out what's the voltage on a cloud that's about to create a lightning bolt. And the conclusion they came to a long time ago is the voltage on the cloud is about 10 to 1 too low to arc the distance between cloud and ground. So the next question is, okay, how in the world does a lightning bolt occur if the voltage on the cloud is not high enough? And the answer is, it doesn't. The actual lightning, the leader strike, only goes approximately 120 feet and stops. And it waits until the very next cosmic ray comes along, then it jumps the next 120 feet. This is the reason why almost every single lightning bolt is zigzagged. It isn't one single process. It's a whole bunch of individual steps. Also, you'll sometimes see a lightning strike when you take a photograph of it. It looks like an upside-down tree. It's got a whole lot of branches to it, and some of the branches reach the ground, and some of them go nowhere. So it's a bunch of cosmic rays that are exciting the process of most lightning. And so that's one of the best explanations as to why it's zigzagged. Now, when it comes to measuring the current that's in a lightning bolt, that's a lot easier to measure than you think. If you've got a calibrated coil, which has a fast-acting voltmeter connected to it, you could probably do it with an oscilloscope, but you'd want some kind of a sampling oscilloscope that's got memory to it. By having a coil in the vicinity, and you measure the amount of voltage that's picked up by the coil, and the orientation of the coil tells you its antenna pattern, and if you can eventually estimate how many feet away or how many miles away was the lightning bolt, you put the two combinations together. The strength of the magnetic field that was picked up by your sensing coil and the distance between your sensing coil and the lightning bolt, that tells you how much current that flows. It's probably got an easy 15% error to it, but that's close enough. That's all you really want to know. So an ordinary negative lightning bolt, around 11,000 amperes, but these positive ones come along, they get closer to 100,000 amperes. There are some super lightning bolts that they get in the northern Pacific during some of those hurricanes and what they call them now. They don't call them tornadoes, hurricanes. I'm trying to think what they call them. Monsoon. Well, some of those monsoons that they get out there, they get well into the 150 and 250,000 ampere on some of those strikes. Really super current flow for brief periods of time. You could produce an amount of power of your electric power station if you could gather that energy. It would be great, but gathering it is not easy, and it's a pretty wicked stuff. So maybe that partially answers your question about, is your antenna going to be exciting lightning bolts? I think not. And how do you measure the current? It's not as difficult as you think when you got that big a current flowing. It creates a EMP, electromagnetic pulse. It really radiates. By the same token, if I take two charged capacitors, one charge negative, one charge positive, so to speak, or, you know, put them together in opposite polarity, and you know you get a great big spark, or when you put a screwdriver across an oil-filled capacitor that's charged to 1,000 volts, you see a great big spark. It wouldn't be very difficult.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It wouldn't be very difficult to measure the current of that discharge by putting a sensing coil nearby of known area going into some kind of a fast-acting voltmeter, storage-type voltmeter, and you can easily estimate the amount of current that happens when you put that screwdriver across those capacitors. So you don't have to make direct contact. Under normal circumstances, when you made that 10 ampere current measurement on your microwave oven, W2RYY did that, what Joe was really doing is putting his ammeter in series with the power supply. Well, you can buy from Sears Roebuck, for instance, a kind of a clamp-on ammeter where you just put it near the 12-volt wire when your starter motor is running, and it'll measure the, by way of the magnetic field that's created, it'll measure how much current is going through that wire, how much current is drawn by your battery into that starter motor. I think you see the process here, Tim. I think it was Tim who asked the original question. Mr. Quadruple W, K2RIW.
I think, yeah, that was the other station that asked about actual values and stuff. You know, because you talk about a lot of these guys that are in the emergency services, and I mean, during all these storms and stuff, they stay on the air, including, you know, all your county seats and all your local municipalities, and a couple of our municipalities in the area has actually taken lightning strikes and knocked their whole repeater system down more than once, especially here in Middletown, New Jersey. They took about 3 lightning strikes in the last 20 years that have ruined their radio system. So, you know, you think about these guys that are sitting there transmitting during these storms, it's quite brave of them, and I'm sure we've never seen a fatality at the microphone per se, and hope we never do. But it's very, very interesting how a lightning strike comes down to go through 3 people, and, you know, thinking about Kirchhoff's laws and stuff about least path of resistance, it's shortest path to ground. It's quite interesting. One thing you can always bank on with a lightning strike, you never know what direction it's going to go. So that's, it's really brought us to some thought this weekend, watching all these strong storms and stuff. So appreciate your answering my question. And that's pretty much it. Appreciate it. WW2WW.
W2PNJ.
W2PNJ recognized. Get to you in a second. It is my guess that if you had a chance to interview those two survivors of the trio of people that were walking off that beach, I bet you they felt something before the actual lightning strike. I bet you their hair was standing on end. The hair on their arm was standing on end. They probably knew something was about to happen. Also, any human being in a body of water, on a body of water, or near a body of water during a lightning storm, all the good books will tell you you're at extremely high risk there. So as you're walking off that beach and you feel this hair-raising experience, in theory you would have increased your chances of survival if you crouch down, put your feet as close together as possible, maybe even 1 foot on top of the other, crouch down to as low a possible position as you can get. They don't want you to lay flat on the beach because the current that flows through the ground when a lightning bolt happens nearby, that can also do some damage to you. I think the best recommendation, though, is to get as low as possible into a crevice somewhere if you can. Well, on a beach, you can't do that. So with hindsight, there's a slim possibility that these three people could have been in better shape had they known what to look for ahead of time. Let's see what Bob's going to say. W2PNJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, good evening, everyone on the net. This is Bob, W2PNJ. My office is in Center Reach, and towards the end of the week, we had another bad lightning storm. And I normally listen to 91.9 FM. It's from the Sachem High School radio station. Well, I was listening to it, and all of a sudden, a tremendous lightning strike close by, and apparently hit the antenna because the station's been off the air for about 3 days now. So it's been quite an experience.
Yeah, run by the call letters again one more time, Bob. That station that got knocked off the air.
I don't recall the call letters, but it's a student-run radio station. The frequency is 91.9 FM, and it's the station's at Sachem High School. They're on Smith Road, or Smith Lane, as you drive by the school. The antenna is to the left of the school as you face the school towards the back in the big open field. And we're over in Center Reach, which is by way of the Crow, about a mile away. And mamma mia, that thing hit. Boom, you know, immediately you saw the light and you heard it at the same time. And at that very same instant, the station went dead. The carrier dropped out. They've been out all week, you know, for the past 3-4 days.
Interesting information, Bob. Yeah, nothing to fool with. When you add all of the protection devices you can to your rig, that includes good grounding on the coax cable, maybe even a lightning bug so that the center conductor can't get high in voltage compared to the shield, proper grounding of the rig itself, particularly a radio tower requires all kinds of grounding. Even an antenna on the roof should have a separate lead going to ground with as straight a wire as possible. You don't want to make any great big bends because the high voltage won't go around the bend very well, so to speak. When you do all those things, you'll rapidly come to the conclusion that it helps, but it's not perfect. A high percentage of the time, the lightning bolt is not striking your antenna. It's striking the 110-volt line, or the equivalent of that, in your neighborhood. If you had X-ray eyes and you look at the wiring of your neighborhood, you'll see that the LIPA and Con Ed and New Jersey Power and Light, each of these power transmission systems and power distribution systems represent a great big grid of wires that covers a lot of square miles. So it's a huge target. And a high percentage of the time, lightning strikes the power line more than your antenna. Your antenna is not that that attractive unless your antenna happens to be mounted on the Empire State Building. So when it comes to various surge protection devices so that the great big spike of voltage that's coming down your 110-volt line, to protect your rig from that will give you a lot of protection. Nothing is perfect. You can have the world's best grounding, the world's best surge protection devices in all locations. If you get one of these super lightning bolt, positive lead, positive polarity type lightning bolts directly hitting your antenna, just the magnetic field it creates in the process of flowing that, well, let me pick a number, 75,000 amperes through whatever it flows through, and the fact that your equipment is nearby. And remember I told you about a coil of wire will pick up the magnetic field? Well, every little transistor, every little loop of chassis you've got is going to be a, by Lenz's law, it's going to be picking up some of that magnetic field and generating a voltage. When you get a strong enough magnetic field, like one of those super lightning bolts, let me drop, you can get a ridiculous number of volts per meter. You can get, for each meter of wire, you can pick up numbers like 10,000 volts across one end versus the other end of a straight out piece of wire in that environment. It's kind of obvious that unless everything is super shielded, you're going to get some damage. So the bottom line of all this is, the good news is that most of us have access to somebody like Andy, the VA2CDL, who can fix almost anything. And so that's going to be required periodically. If you've taken all the protection in the world, occasionally you're going to get some damage. Quite often the front-end transistor, the low-noise amplifier, gets blown, and that transistor, in many cases, is worth $4. So the raw parts to do the repair are not so bad. Your best attitude you can have is say, I'm willing to fix it. And I've done all the right things to give me as much protection as I can get, but don't expect it to be perfect. When it comes to lightning, nothing is perfect. I may have told you guys about the case of one of the antennas that were manufactured by my former company, Airborne Instruments Laboratory. It was a great big, I think it was in the vicinity of 10 or 12 inch diameter radome on this antenna that was in the vicinity of 20 feet tall, and that was mounted on top of a mountain in Scandinavia. And when lightning struck it, not only did it melt metallic parts inside, but it blasted that radome. And so on top of a granite mountain in Scandinavia during one of these worst case of lightning storms, boy, there's very little protection. Various people around those time were asking me, what is the right protection? My answer was, put a Rhone 45 radio tower alongside of that antenna, make sure the radio tower is well grounded, make sure the radio tower is taller than the antenna one you want to protect. Now lightning will strike it instead of the antenna. They were going to beef up the antenna itself, hoping to make it survive that kind of a lightning bolt in that environment. I think the chances of doing that are very slim. How do you multiply the components of an antenna by 100 to 1 and still have it tuned to the same frequency? Very, very difficult thing to do. My suggestion was to put a tower side by side. They didn't do it, and so every year those antennas came back and needed repair. Let's see. I bet you've seen some awfully wicked lightning because you live very close to the seashore there, Mel. Over the years, I bet you've had people in your neighborhood suffer damage.
Here, Jack.
Okay. Eric first. Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ. And how are things at your broadcast station in this episode? K2RIW and TechNet.
K2RIW or KE2EJ? If you remember, I think it was about 4 weeks ago, I got a really nasty lightning, a direct lightning hit to the tower. Most transmitters didn't mind it at all, but the EMP pulse that it makes, well, all that magnetic energy that gets inducted into wires, pretty much wiped out devices in the other building that had wires connected to them that you send data down. So a lot of data receivers, they just... the inputs to the data receivers, a lot of them are threats, and they just opened up. I think it took me about a week to change all the parts and everything, but the transmitters, they don't care. You hit the antenna directly with lightning. It's like I was in the transmitter room at that moment. Everything just turned.